On this week's 51%, a campaign and leadership program is training women to run as they are for political office.
The skills you have, the talents you have, the motivation you have, that is enough to get you started and get you running for office.
Hear about the author who revolutionized children's picture books, and writer Dr. Jerry Burns returns with another point of view. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
I gotta be me. This dream that I see makes me what I am. That faraway pride, a world of success, is waiting for me if I heed the call. I won't settle down or settle for less. As long as there's half a chance, I can have it all.
Vote Run Lead trains women to run for office and win. With more than 33,000 women trained to run for office, Vote Run Lead is the largest campaign and leadership program in the country, working to equip women with the right know-how and training to help them enter politics with a purpose. Vote Run Lead empowers women to run as they are, build a campaign based on their own passions, ideas, and values. Erin Velarde is founder and CEO of Vote Run Lead and begins by speaking to the record number of women sworn in for the new Congress.
Well, Vote Run Lead is thrilled to see the diversity of women, both in age, you know, 28 to, I can't remember how old Donna Shalala is. But, you know, we have a real diverse group of women across geography, across race, across religion. And I think for the first time we're seeing the power of women who said, I'm going to be the one to do this. I'm going to be the one to step up and represent my community. Because previously, I think we were maybe looking around for others who we might have thought were more qualified or had more political experience than us. But I think this year really broke the mold about who can be an elected official, even at the highest levels.
How do you take this and run with it? No pun intended, toward 2020. I mean, do you just run on this momentum? Is it momentum?
It is momentum because people are very inspired to see someone who looks like them, to see someone who has small children, like an Ilhan Omar with three kids, you know, to see someone who is, you know, has a non-traditional political, you know, non-traditional experience, translate that into political power. So that makes it very doable, and it changes the mindset of women to say, oh, I can run for my city council. You know, the original motivation, if you will, in seeing a man get to the highest office in the land with no military or political experience is then bolstered by the motivation of seeing women with diverse experiences actually say, I can translate that into the electoral system. And so it feels very doable, it feels very real.
You know, you mentioned city council, and then there's school boards and county executive positions. These are all very important posts, often serving as launching pads to higher office. But we do see women in the most public eye on the congressional level. But what is going on locally?
Right. And there are 19,000 school board seats up this year in 2019. There are 7,000 county seats and, you know, tens of thousands of municipal elections happening in 2019. I don't think people realize that there are over 500,000 elected positions in the United States. 519,002. It's my favorite number. That means that there's a seat for you. And so what we're doing at Vote Run Lead is beginning to share with folks that demystification, right? You don't have to be one of the 435 members of the House or 100 of the Senate. You can be one of the 500,000 seats. And sometimes those races cost a few $100s, or you can run it on, you know, your own sweat equity and a couple of volunteers. Figuring out how much a city council race might cost you $10,000 in fundraising. That might feel a lot more doable than thinking you have to raise $1 million and, you know, have a digital strategy, right? No, these are your neighbors. Making the political very local for folks and showing them a couple of clear steps on how to get there and how to do it.
What are some challenges in women seeking office and how do you overcome them?
One of the big challenges we see is around fundraising. So making sure that women understand what the actual numbers are, which takes some of that fear away, but giving them really tangible steps to raise money. And, you know, for working class or lower income women, our personal networks might not be, you know, that friends and family route. You may have to think a little bit differently and think outside the box. And so at Vote Run Lead, we're actually giving them examples of women of different economic backgrounds about how they raised enough funds and how they made it happen to meet their goals. The second piece is it's now public, right? This is the part of, you know, public office that's a little bit scary is the public piece. Beginning to, you know, speak publicly, have people, you know, critique your public speaking. Is your message resonating? that's actually one of our strongest trainings, because we're not out there telling women how to list off their resumes or, you know, drab along with your three top issues. We're asking them to tell stories about their experiences and how those experiences make them expert. And when you do that, you have an emotional resonance with a voter. You have a donor who's going to want to invest in you, because you're showing them that you've taken leadership. You're showing them that you know, done something in your life sort of that's been bold, or instead of telling them, oh, I'm going to be a bold leader. And that's probably one of our most transformative trainings, is getting women to talk about themselves by telling the stories of when they were badass in their past. And that really unlocks all of those little ticks we might have, you know, if our voice quivers or our knee shakes. Telling authentic stories about yourself, telling the truth about yourself, all of that little stuff washes away and you really become a more powerful public speaker. So knocking down those fundraising barriers and building up women's storytelling abilities are both, you know, the sort of barriers and challenges as well as the opportunities to running for office.
Erin, do you think women are still falling into, I'll call it, the male trap, where we've had men in the highest elected positions and that's what we know? We're finally learning to forge our own path and show what it looks like to potentially have a woman as president rather than have a woman trying to fit into what men have molded as the role to be filled. So how is Vote Run Lead working to help women form their own identities and not fall into an already constructed male role?
You're hitting it right on the head. The curriculum is called Run As You Are. And following the 2016 election, we had to update the curriculum because women were saying, no, I'm not going to follow that traditional pathway. Look what happened to Hillary Clinton, who felt, you know, the constant tug between being man enough for the job and the most overqualified woman. And so women came to us and said, we've got to do this differently. And we had been doing it for a long time, but to name it, to call it Run As You Are, really struck as both a methodology and a message for women right now, because you're exactly right. They're coming to the table because who they've been is who they believe is going to be high impact in public office. And they don't want to be the political robots. Young women are wearing colorful dresses. You see ethnic clothing come out. The non-traditional hairstyles, right? No one's wearing curls anymore. We're both doing it in our fashion and in our how we're expressing ourselves outwardly, and we're doing it in who we want to be on the campaign trail.
Okay, I'm going to throw out some names and just get your reaction. Democratic House Leader Nancy Pelosi.
Twice elected speaker. I mean, I think that woman wields power probably better than any man or woman I've seen wield power in, you know, the 15 years I've been doing this work. She understands how to pull and push the levers of power.
And the youngest woman to serve in Congress, 29-year-old Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, also a Democrat.
Unapologetically herself, and believes in her own abilities and trusts her instincts.
And then what about Democratic Michigan Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, who made headlines across the country when she called President Trump a curse word and stood by it in the following days? Disservice or service to women in elected office?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's a service, because it's women behaving badly is something we've got to see more of. And the idea of her, you know, using a curse word as if it's this huge, you know, oh my gosh, I can't believe that, like, a woman has cursed. It's like, great, let's get over this, right? Let's have it happen and get over it, because it's actually not that deep. So does she probably wish it wasn't recorded? I don't know, maybe. But she's actually stood by this to say, I've come to Washington to shake things up. Behavior is changing. How people are really finding a lot of these women via social media very accessible. There's no more, you know, political talk and then, you know, you get straight talk behind the scenes. You're getting straight talk all the time. And I think that Rashida's giving it straight. She comes from Detroit. She knows who her base is. She knows who her district is that elected her. And I think it's very clear that Rashida is not going to be somebody who ever listens when someone tells her to be quiet.
Thank you for that. I mean, it's not like others aren't saying similar words. It's just that they're not always caught on mic.
Yeah, it's not that it's not being said. It's not that we all haven't said something worse, you know, in thinking about our frustrations. She's emotional about it. I think we actually want emotional women. I'm interested in seeing emotional women. I think it's been really fun to actually see some of these emotional men, too, on Twitter, particularly in response to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. They get very, very emotional about it. And so I like what they're bringing out. I also think Rashida is giving some cover to the rest of the party. You know, she said what she needed to say. There's a specific wing of the party who believes this.
and hopefully gets rid of the repression and suppression that can be hypocritical. So moving to 2020, what is Vote Run Lead doing in preparation? And leading up to that presidential election, several women have said they're considering a run or being talked about as potentially running. I'm thinking of, off the top of my head, three Democratic U.S. senators: Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, Kamala Harris of California. What do you say about the number of women already being talked about?
We are going to have a tremendous amount of choice for the women that we want to see potentially lead this country. We have never seen the kind of choices that we will see in coming out of 2020 for a woman president. It'll be at least four, if not six, women who are throwing their hat in the ring, and they'll be from all over the country. I also think you're going to see some female governors step in, some names that we're not as familiar with. So I'm excited about that. You'll also see, again, racial and ethnic diversity. A lot of the firsts, you know, we know with Kamala Harris, she'll be, you know, we're pretty sure she'll be throwing her hat in the ring as well. And as those women can be motivators, Vote Run Lead is focusing on the local offices around the country. How do we get you running for the state legislature? In May of this year, we're doing a big conference in about 10 cities across the country, all on the same day, in various locations. So we hope folks will stay tuned for that one-day training. Ideally, it'll be, and hopefully it'll be, the largest training of women we've ever seen. And we want to do that so that folks know that elections are happening all across the country all the time, and we want you to consider running as you are.
What's the one thing you would say to women who maybe had never thought about running for office, but now are thinking, hey, maybe I should?
You are enough. The skills you have, the talents you have, the motivation you have, that is enough to get you started and get you running for office. And groups like Vote Run Lead and others can, you know, give you the tactics and the skills you might need, but you are enough to help shape and change the future of this country where you want to see it.
That was Erin Velarde. She is founder and CEO of Vote Run Lead. She mentioned Democratic Congresswoman Donna Shalala as being one of the older newbies to Congress at age 77. Another Democrat, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, is one of the first Muslim women and first Somali American serving in Congress. Decades before Cat in the Hat, another children's book surprised readers with its inventiveness. Millions of Cats by Minnesota's Wanda Gogg combined illustration and text on the same page in a way people had not seen before. KFAI's Emily Bright reports.
In Minneapolis, I'm Emily Bright. The story of the Minnesota author who revolutionized children's picture books begins with a trip into a cavern.
So now we're going to go 90 feet below the surface.
This is Lisa von Drasek. She's the curator of the Children's Research Library at the University of Minnesota.
I'm just going to turn with the lights, and now it's very dark.
Wow, this is a lot.
Oh, this just keeps going.
Filed among these floor-to-ceiling shelves are 7 to 8 boxes with artist notebooks, editorial artwork, and photos of a sassy woman in a 1920s flapper haircut. That woman is Wanda Gogg. And I was here to find out one thing. Wanda Gogg, what makes her cool?
Well, there's a lot that makes her cool. She really is the artist that created the modern American picture book.
Gogg wrote and illustrated Millions of Cats in 1928, and it's never been out of print. Millions of Cats changed the way picture books were made.
Wanda Gogg created picture books that integrated the physical text, the story, with the pictures.
Before that, children's books had separate pages of illustration inserted into books, like a break in the story. Gogg made the two work together on the same page spread. Her brother hand-lettered the text.
So we're looking at this pen and ink across the page. I'm looking at the one where she says, "If only we had a cat," sighed the very old woman. "I will get you a cat, my dear," said the very old man. Now that's on the left-hand side of the page. And then our eyes sweep across the horizontal page. And he set out over the hills. And right above those words, you see him setting out over the hills. And you see the hills rolling above the text. And you see the clouds rolling above the hills. And the man is walking to the right so that our eyes go to the next page. And when we turn the next page, the intention of her was to say, "Whoa," to this picture. Because suddenly we see cats here, cats there, cats and kittens everywhere, hundreds of cats, thousands of cats, millions and billions and trillions of cats.
The words are stacked in columns when the very old man stands still, looking for the prettiest cat. They march across the page as he and the cats go home. Every placement pushes you to turn the page. People hadn't thought to do that before.
The art form of the picture book in words and pictures is all intentional.
How does she know this?
Okay, you said, what's the coolest thing? I could just, like, cry how cool this is.
In the library reading room, von Dresick pulls out the first printed copy of Millions of Cats. It's a 90-year-old proof copy for the author. Scrawled across the black and white pages is Gog's neat cursive in red pencil. All last-minute corrections.
There is not a page where she is happy. She wants all of the text moved up the page. She doesn't like where it is, and she needs this one line moved to the right. We turn the page. She says, be careful that these two pages match in the center. She was a perfectionist in the best sense of the word because she knew exactly how she wanted this book to look when you first held it in your hand.
All her corrections were made.
On one page, she actually writes, okay. Okay.
Now, 90 years after its publication, a book read by millions and billions and trillions of readers still delights.
And it was a very pretty cat after all, said the very old woman. It is the most beautiful cat in the whole world, said the very old man. I ought to have known, for I have seen hundreds of cats, thousands of cats, millions and billions and trillions of cats, and not one was as pretty as this one.
Nor few as rule-breaking and successful. For KFAI, I'm Emily Bright.
Critics have been on the case of one of the tech industry's largest trade shows for not including enough female speakers. That changed this year at CES, the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. One of the event's most outspoken critics, a group called Gender Avenger, recently awarded CES a gold stamp of approval for a 2019 roster of keynote and featured speakers that the group says is 45% women, 60% of them women of color. Leveling the playing field often means more than inviting female CEOs to speak. Attendance, for example, is still largely male, reflecting the gender imbalance of the broader tech industry. And police are closing rape investigations at the lowest rate in decades, despite advancements in forensic testing. That's according to FBI data showing sexual assault is second only to robbery in the least solved categories of violent crime. Police nationwide cleared just 32% of rape investigations last year. That rate has fallen from 62% in 1964. The decline in clearance rate comes even as the Me Too movement is empowering women to speak up against sexual assault. Rape remains among the most underreported crimes, with studies showing as few as 1 in 3 victims report to law enforcement. Sexual assault is among the most difficult crimes to solve, as the cases often lack witnesses and physical evidence. But several experts say police have not dedicated sufficient resources to investigating rape. And now, writer Dr. Jerry Burns brings us other points of view.
I saw a quote recently that grabbed my heart. Often misattributed to Maya Angelou, it is from the writer and folklorist Zora Neale Thurston, and it goes like this. There is no agony like bearing an untold story inside you. Zora Neale Thurston speaks with wisdom, doesn't she? I know, because I'm feeling the agony right now. You see, I heard a story that must be shared. It's not my story, but I have the blessing of the man involved to share it with you. My friend is a chaplain at a hospital. I have a few friends who do similar work, and I have so much respect for them. Chaplains, and while we're on the topic, hospice workers, are unsung heroes, plain and simple. Okay, now back to the story. My friend works at a very large hospital and keeps very busy. He meets people in all types of challenging situations and does what he can to bring them spiritual comfort. On one fine fall day, he visited a new patient. The sick man was in bed, hooked up to monitors, and his wife stood guard at his side, her face drawn and tight with concern. They were a Muslim couple who hardly spoke English. Communication between them and the chaplain was very difficult. The chaplain told them who he was and what he did, but there wasn't much of a response. They just didn't understand. When the chaplain ultimately left the room, the wife followed him into the hallway. Between gestures and a few words, he realized that she really wanted to know who he was. My friend tried. He said, "I'm the chaplain." But she shook her head. He said, "Pastor." But there was no response. He screwed up his eyes as he considered other synonyms for chaplain, priest, minister. Still, she shook her head. Then his crinkled up eyes smoothed out with realization. He pointed to his heart and said, "Imam." At that moment, her eyes lit up and her smile broke through her heavy mask of worry. She nodded a few times and thanked him. Then the chaplain said, "Salam." The woman beamed and returned to her husband's bedside. While my friend doesn't know exactly how that interaction impacted the patient's wife, he did feel a palpable connection between them, an understanding that went beyond words, that broke through the language and cultural barrier. The two of them connected, heart to heart, spirit to spirit, and he was humbled. Sometimes those who are charged to bring solace to others receive solace as well. I was deeply touched when I heard the chaplain's story. I was touched not only by the tale, but because it reminded me how important it is to look beyond the familiar comfort of our own language or worldview, how necessary it is to look into the words and worlds of others. By doing this, we really can break down culturally imposed boundaries and connect human to human, not category to category. Perhaps you can think of a time when you successfully straddled a language or cultural barrier to communicate with someone from another culture, like the chaplain did. Or maybe you remember when you were the lucky recipient of a similar overture. Each important experience, built one after another, bridges cultural divides. But culture isn't the only thing that divides people. With so much extreme political strife nowadays, our country has stratified itself into many different camps. Blue and red political groups spring immediately to mind. So what would happen if we extend the chaplain's story into the realm of politics? If we can communicate across cultures by recognizing others, can't we also acknowledge and affirm those with whom we don't agree? Even tiny baby steps of recognition could help pave the long road to healing. We saw how the hospital chaplain built a bridge across culture. In addition to building cultural bridges, maybe we can also build purple bridges between the red and the blue. Look, I'm not in fantasy land. I don't expect a world of unicorns and rivers of milk and honey, though that would be nice. I just fervently hope and believe that people can truly recognize each other for the human beings we all are, no matter where we are born, how we vote, love, pray, identify, and all the rest of those things that turn humans into categories. All we have to do is extend a little effort by looking beyond our own beliefs and recognizing someone else, just like a certain hospital chaplain did one fine fall day.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. She is co-author of the recently published book, Story Twisting, A Guide to Remixing and Reinventing Stories. Burns also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett and Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1539.